Thousands of families in Orange County are impacted by the final decision to close 7 schools. It's a decision that brought some district leaders to tears, and one they may have to make again in the months ahead as public school enrollment continues to decline. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. It's Thursday, March 12th, 2026. With fewer students and declining enrollment, Orange County public school leaders say they just don't have the money to keep under-enrolled schools open. That's what led to what happened at the school board meeting Tuesday night.
This is certainly one of the most difficult days in my superintendency. Never would I have thought that we would be closing schools in a district that values public education, that has the support of our community. And so it has been an incredibly difficult process for us.
In Florida, funding for schools is tied to enrollment. It's allocated per student. A decrease in enrollment means less funding. According to the district's data, enrollment dropped by about 5,600 students, costing Orange County Public Schools more than $41 million in state funding this year.
With a very, very heavy heart, I move that we close Bonneville Elementary.
Each of the schools on the chopping block was voted on individually after a short staff presentation on enrollment numbers and how students could be rezoned. Board members were visibly struggling through each motion. Some wiped away tears, voices cracked. In previous meetings, families spoke out passionately against the closures, but relatively few community members were in the room for the final decision. One by one, the board voted to consolidate and close.
So again, it's heartbreaking, but I will make the motion with a heavy heart to close Union Park Middle School and rezone the students to Discovery, Glen Ridge, Legacy, Odyssey, and Robert Clemente Middle School. And I'm so very sorry that we had to do this.
Thank you, Member Gallo. I appreciate that. I appreciate the difficulty of this. Is there a second? Second by Member Ferrant. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries unanimously.
The vote means 6 elementary schools, McCoy, Bonneville, Orla Vista, Chickasaw, Eccleston, and Meadow Woods, along with Union Park Middle School, will close this summer. Their students will be rezoned and sent to 17 other schools. The superintendent says affected families and staff will receive more information soon about next steps. The closures are the result of a steady decline in enrollment across Orange County. School Board Chair Teresa Jacobs says the drop is driven by factors including more students choosing charter or private schools, lower birth rates, and changes in where families are choosing to live.
There was a comment that our lower socioeconomic schools are receiving less money, and that's not true. The funding for each school is tied directly to the students. The funding comes from the state. It's allocated per student. If a school has lower enrollment, then they are going to have less funding. But it is not a matter of funding being divvied up based on economics or race or ethnicity. I am happy to say those days are behind us in terms of the funding formula that the state uses.
Still, the decision is deeply disappointing for parents who attended the meeting like Michelle Harris.
Right now, it's just an overwhelming emotion.
Harris has 2 students at Eccleston Elementary.
For my family, it would pretty much be just trying to figure out what school my children would go to next, like what looks right for them as far as safety, as far as education, as far as the school and staff, that's important to me. For me, I'm looking at all options. I'm also speaking with the parents within the school to see what we feel like is best for us. If we can find another school to go to besides the one that they decided to zone us for without giving us an option or decision, then that's just the route that we would take.
District leaders say affected families will have time to apply to attend other schools throughout the controlled open enrollment process. Tiffany Marable also has 2 children at the elementary school. She says parents tried to stop the closures during weeks of community meetings where families were invited to share their feedback before the board's vote.
Well, I have two kids that attend Upstate Elementary. They're in first grade. I've been a part of the petitions, the emails, all that kind of stuff. It's just sad. I felt like they already knew, and they just drug us along.
Superintendent Maria Vasquez cautioned that if enrollment doesn't rebound, more school closures could be coming in the years ahead.
The reason we came to this difficult decision is because we wanted to continue to have schools where all of our children have access to the supports and the resources so that we didn't have the haves and the have-nots. And so ironically, that is why we chose to bring this proposal, the proposal for the 7 closures before the board. I wish I could sit here and tell you that this will be the end. Sadly, it is not the end. We continue to see declining enrollment. We are looking at projections of 5,000 more students that we are losing. And so it is our intent to listen to the concerns that you've stated, and we will be going out much sooner to those schools and informing them of their numbers, reviewing their trends before the end of this school year. That way there is time in the summer to be able to see if families can be recruited back, and then we'll have more conversations in the fall.
The Orange County School Board has a contract with a Tennessee company that helps recruit students back to public schools. District leaders say CAESA K-12 brought nearly 2,000 students back to OCPS in its first year under a contract that pays the company $935 per returning student. Each student generates nearly $9,000 in funding for the district. Engage producer Richard Copeland spoke with Orange County Public Schools Chief Communications Officer Scott Howitt the morning after the vote about some of those next steps as the enrollment challenges continue.
We saw 7 individual votes pass to close 6 elementary schools, 1 middle school at the end of this school year. In the case of Union Park Middle School, 558 students will be rezoned to 5 other middle schools. Are these schools that will be absorbing these students, not just from Union Park, but the others, are they equipped to handle this increase in their student body?
They are, absolutely. We've worked with the other schools to ensure that they have the capacity and the resources to serve the children. And that's part of the reason why we were doing the consolidations in the first place, is to ensure that all of our students have the resources that they need in order to be successful and to provide that high quality education at every school. If we were to keep students in lower enrolled schools, with less resources, less revenue, they wouldn't be able to have the same level of education as those that are in schools that are enrolled at or near capacity.
Last night, Superintendent Vasquez indicated more schools would be alerted by the end of the year, as the district is projected to lose another 5,000 students in the next school year, the 26-27 school year. Are those evaluations currently underway, and how are they evaluating where these student decreases might occur?
Those evaluations have been ongoing. I think looking at enrollment trends as far as resides in a zone versus attends, and how many students actually are within a zone that could enroll or will enroll at a school, is very important. We have a demographer that looks at all of that data and analyzes that regularly. I think the biggest thing that what we've seen is a decline, like we said, in enrollment, and the students just haven't shown up. It's not that the students are leaving these schools or have left these schools recently. It's been a decline because of things that are happening within our society, within our country. We're seeing lower birth rates. We're seeing changes in immigration policy. We're seeing changes in school choice. Those things have caused families to have less children or no children. The housing costs have forced families maybe to stay in their home and not sell their home and downsize, where new families would move in and you'd have turnover in neighborhoods. So there's a lot of things and factors that are happening. And so we've been analyzing all of that over time. Our incoming kindergarten cohort is smaller this year than it ever has been, while our graduating class last year was the largest it had ever been in OCPS history. So you're looking at these dynamics and we're analyzing those and trying to really determine where our resources are best placed in order to make sure that the students that we have in our schools are served in the most efficient and the most high quality that we can provide as far as our education.
How will the staff of these seven schools be? Will they be relocated? Will they be reassigned? How will they be distributed? And will it be across admin, classroom, and facility support?
So we've worked with both of the support staff union, OESPA, and our teachers union, the Classroom Teachers Association, to work out an agreement on how we would go about the process. And so we notified them back in February that there would be a process for that. And they're going through that process now. We have a reappointment process that this was integrated into in order to help support them to find positions. It may not be necessarily at the consolidated school. It may be at another school. Certainly, the consolidated schools are going to need classroom teachers because they're populations are increasing, and we need a certain number of teachers for a certain number of student ratio. So those will be opportunities for the teachers to be hired at the receiving schools, but some of the other instructional positions maybe aren't necessarily tied to student ratios, and we'll work to help find them other positions throughout the district. We want all of our teachers that work for us now and have dedicated their lives to teaching our students to find a position within Orange County Public Schools. And we're going to do everything we can to try to make that happen.
Beyond just these closings and potential closings that we're talking about, how has the paradigm of public school education within Orange County shifted when taking into account these lowered birth rates, movement due to housing costs, immigration policies, the state's voucher system supporting charters and homeschooling and such? What other changes within the district will these affect?
I think the shift is understanding that with a shrinking number of students that are out there because of those things, because of birth rates, because of declining enrollment, the number becomes more competitive as school choice ramps up. So I think, you know, for us, we understand that it's very important for us to speak to families about the amazing things that are offered within our schools within Orange County. How do we share the opportunities that their children have that they would not have in a charter school, or if they were homeschooled, or if they were at a private school? We educate close to 80% of all the students within Orange County, and sharing their experiences and what they have at their fingertips when it comes to resources and assets is important for us. And that takes marketing. It takes communication. And that's a lot of what we're doing and focusing on to make sure that our schools are getting out that good news about what's happening within their schools. And regardless of the student, it's for all students, whether you're a student with unique needs, or you're a gifted student, or you're a student that comes from a challenging financial situation, or you're a student who comes from a wealthy background. We want to make sure that every single student has the opportunity that they need to be successful when they graduate from Orange County Public Schools. We're very proud of our graduation rate. It's 97.2%. And we want to make sure that our parents know and our families know that those opportunities to go on to college and career are in front of them right here in Orange County Public Schools.
That was Orange County Public Schools Chief Communications Officer Scott Howitt speaking with Engage producer Richard Copeland. If you're a parent in Central Florida with concerns about what declines in enrollment mean for your child's education or school, we want to hear from you. Send an email to engage@cfpublic.org or send a talkback on the Central Florida Public Media app. There's more ahead on Engage. There's always something in the air in Central Florida. Dr. Ariana Becker explains why allergy season seems to last all year here and what to do about it. And a significant step forward in building a permanent memorial at the Pulse nightclub nearly 10 years after the deadly attack. This is Engage on Central Florida Public Media. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you never miss an episode.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
You are listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. This week, demolition crews took down that iconic Pulse sign at the site of the former nightclub nearly 10 years after the 2016 mass shooting that took the lives of 49 people and injured dozens more. The sign removal is part of the process of clearing that site to make way for a permanent memorial commemorating the people who died there. Central Florida Public Media's Joe Mario Pedersen was at that Pulse site this week as the sign was taken down and joins us to talk about it. Thanks for being here, Joe Mario.
Hey, good to be here, Sharon.
So that Pulse black and white sign and all that it has come to mean to people, it was difficult to miss when driving down Orange Avenue. What was that moment like when it came down?
I think it's fair to say it was a little surreal. There was a few people there who came to witness, the sign coming down, and they all agreed that it was coming down with some mixed emotions. But for myself personally, and I think that this is true for, all of us who have been covering this since the Pulse shooting first happened in 2016, that I think why it's surreal is seeing the sign come down and how unchanged the sign looks despite the passage of 10 years, right? And I think there is a little bit of symbolism to that, right? With all that's happened in 10 years, this sign relatively unchanged until it has come down just earlier this week. And still no permanent memorial, right? So I think to actually see that happen, right? This really big change on this property. Yeah, I think surreal is the right word for it. And Sharon, I guess to really capitalize on the surrealty of that, right? Crew workers raised the club sign high into the air before gently laying it on a truck bed for transport ahead of, planned demolition of the building next week. James Houchins, he's a member of the LGBTQ plus community from Castleberry. And he says he visits the Pulse site frequently. And he was one of those who was experiencing some mixed emotions as the sign came down.
When you're out here just visiting or anything, it's been a sign of hope. It's been a sign of community. It's been a sign of hurt.
The Pulse nightclub first opened its doors in 2004. And had served as a welcome beacon to the LGBTQ plus community before the shooting. However, the club never reopened after that night.
So now that the sign is down and demolition on the building will begin next week, what does it symbolize for people?
Back to this mixed emotions, right? I've heard some people say that this feels like a step in the right direction. There are also those who feel as though the proposed plans for the memorial are a bit too much, like an Orlando attraction. But the thing that I think both sides agree on, right, no matter how you're looking at this, is that with the sign coming down and with the building being demolished, there is this sense of healing. I've heard the word healing used a lot since planning for a permanent memorial kicked into high gear last year. And for the first and only time, family members of those who were killed and survivors were allowed to go inside the building over the summer.
Thinking about that process of healing, this has been going on a long time. Why has it taken so long to get to this point? The permanent memorial was supposed to be built years ago, right?
Yeah, that's right. So while it has been serving as a temporary memorial to those who were killed, it was only intended to do so for a few years. An organization called the One Pulse Foundation was established to create a permanent memorial. It was also going to build a museum. And we even saw some of the concept art of that at one point. It was going to cost tens of millions of dollars to produce that. However, the foundation became mired in controversy, accused of misspending donations and taxpayer funds. And back in 2023, the foundation was dissolved. The city of Orlando later purchased the Pulse nightclub property and promised it would build a permanent memorial.
So we heard from James Houchins, who was out watching the sign come down earlier this week. Were you able to speak with anyone else? How are they feeling?
I ran into Orlando District 4 Commissioner Patty Sheehan, who was also there to watch the sign come down. She says she knows that for some people, this will help with their healing and hopes that in the end, the community gets what it needs.
That's a wound that will never heal for them. All we can hope to do is give them some solace of knowing that we care, and that's what this memorial is about.
Sheehan told me taking down the sign is the first step toward physically changing the property. And she said it's emotional. She sees two tragedies tied to the site, the massacre 10 years ago, and what she described as the One Pulse Foundation taking millions from the community. For her, this moment feels like a clean slate.
So, Joe Mario, do we have any idea what the city will do with the sign now that it's down?
Yeah, we do. The city told us the sign is headed to a climate-controlled storage. City of Orlando officials say it will be preserved and incorporated into the final memorial design. Parts of the original nightclub will also be saved and are also in storage. Designers shared plans to put a portion of the original dance floor under a reflection pool to preserve the spirit of Pulse as a place known for music, dance, and community. The breach wall officers broke through the night of the shooting will be saved and incorporated as well. Planners say they're about a third of the way done with the design work right now.
And can you walk us through the timeline of what happens next?
The building demolition is planned for next week to clear the site for a permanent memorial. Construction is scheduled to start this September, with completion planned for September 2027.
Central Florida Public Media's Joe Mario Pedersen, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
This is Engage on Central Florida Public Media. If it feels like allergy season never really ends here, there's actually a reason for that. Different plants release pollen at different times of the year. For many people, that means months of sneezing, congestion, and itchy eyes. Advent Health family medicine physician Dr. Ariana Becker says she sees it frequently in her practice. She talks about allergies in Central Florida and what can be done to mitigate them.
So there are a lot of patients struggling with allergies, especially in the last month or so, I would say. And they're coming in with sneezing, difficulty breathing, itchy eyes, watery eyes, rashes, postnasal congestion, postnasal drip, and sometimes even fatigue.
What do you think's going on in the last month that led to the increase?
So in Central Florida, there are so many allergens all year long. It can feel like allergy season never ends. But specifically right now, the tree pollen is what tends to peak during this time. And patients can actually look at pollen.com. There's a website that tells you what different things are pollinating at the current time in different locations. And right now, the tree pollen is really what's getting a lot of people.
Are you seeing rates of allergies increase over the years, or does it stay pretty steady?
We do see rates of allergies increase over the years, and a lot of that's due to climate change. In fact, 67 million people suffer from allergies, and over 80% of those people are allergic to pollen. So it does relate to climate change, and it's a very interesting thing how we see these allergies just continue to increase.
So why is it that Central Florida has this year-round allergy season compared to other parts of the country? Is it related to our weather?
Yes, that's a great question. So our warm temperatures allow different plants and trees to pollinate at different times throughout the year. So instead of one defined allergy season, we often see multiple waves. In colder climates, they don't really get that because of the winter time. So in Florida, a lot of people struggle at various times of the year. So tree pollen tends to peak in the spring. Grass pollen is usually late spring and summer. And ragweed and weeds can flare up in the fall typically. And then on top of that, we have dust mites and mold and pet dander, which can be inside and trigger people all year long.
Hearing you mention mold actually made me think of just hurricane season and just wet conditions. I'm wondering if that also can make things worse.
Absolutely. Both mold and dust mites thrive in this warm, humid weather. So we get it worse than other places.
Other parts of the country that just get, you know, months of frigid cold weather, does that kind of create a break from allergies for most people and just kind of stop everything?
Exactly. It creates a little bit of a break. And people's allergies tend to improve. And that's why people will get this nasal congestion in the springtime, and then it'll kind of get better. And in Florida, it can happen, peak again, and just happen and continue to increase and decrease at different times of the year.
This is a question I'm sure you get all the time. But for people wondering, do I have allergies or am I getting sick? How do you know the difference?
So that is a common question that I get all the time. Allergies and an infection like cold or flu can be difficult to differentiate sometimes. Allergies usually cause sneezing, itchy eyes, a clear runny nose, and some nasal congestion, and it'll usually last for weeks to months and often flare up when you are exposed to the allergen. So sometimes people notice it gets worse when they go outdoors. Colds and the flu are more likely to cause fevers, body aches, fatigues, and the nasal discharge is usually thicker. And those symptoms typically improve after about 7 to 10 days. So if you have persistent symptoms without a fever and you have these itchy eyes or sneezing, allergies are often the culprit. So you may want to speak with your doctor to come up with a treatment plan.
Can you help me understand how people develop allergies as an adult? Is that genetic?
There can be genetic predispositions. And oftentimes people will live in different areas. I have so many patients that have moved from out of state into Florida. And oftentimes they'll say, I think I'm just allergic to Florida. So it has to do with the environment that you're in and what you've been exposed to previously in your life. But there's no way to really stop it from occurring other than trying to prevent it earlier and trying to stay on top of some of the preventive measures you can do. So for example, if you're allergic to the pollen, you want to keep the windows closed, you want to have your air conditioning on, you can use the high efficiency filters to try to help with that. But sometimes it's really tough to stay away from your allergens when they are outdoors or when you live in a home with a pet. It's difficult to prevent it from happening.
A couple of people I work with here complain about it being worse in the morning. Any thoughts on why allergies can feel worse then?
Yeah, so people often will complain of worse allergies in the morning. They're allergic to dust mites. And the reason is we have dust mites in our pillowcases. So people with very bad allergies, I recommend that they change their sheets in really hot water at least once a week if they can. And there are also pillow covers that you can get to put inside of your pillowcase that can help reduce some of the allergens and reduce some of those symptoms for the people who wake up with the real stuffy nose and the itchy eyes.
Local honey. Does eating local honey actually help build up a resistance to local pollen and allergies?
That's a great one. So I think it actually does help build up some of that immunity to the local plants. So when you get a honey, if you can get it from a local source, I do think that it can help. Other things that can help that are sort of along the same lines are immunotherapy. So sometimes patients who have really bad allergies will go see an ENT or an allergist, and they will expose them to small amounts of whatever the allergen is so that they stop reacting as much. And it's a process that takes time, but it can be very effective.
I think that I have to ask you, because people will want to know this most, what do I do if I am suffering allergies? How do I get treatment? How do I get it under control?
So luckily, there are a lot of different over-the-counter treatments that you can try. There are two main types of nasal sprays. Nasal corticosteroids are the first line, and you'll just use the nasal spray when you administer it. You want to use your right hand, go your left nostril, left hand, go to your right nostril so that you don't just spray it right into your septum. But this nasal corticosteroid will help with the inflammation in your nasal passages. It does take a few weeks of regular use to see the effects, but it's okay to use this daily. The other one is Astelin nasal spray, which is a nasal antihistamine. So just like an oral antihistamine, it just works locally in your nasal passages. So you can use one or the other, or sometimes both for people who have really severe allergies. And both of these are now over the counter. There are also oral antihistamines that people can use. So you hear of loratadine or cetirizine. These are common ones that people will try to alleviate some of their allergy symptoms. These can be taken on an as-needed basis. A lot of people will have to use fluticasone or Astelin nasal spray or take a Claritin during certain seasons, and then they don't have to take it during other parts of the year, depending on what they're allergic to. Nasal salings and irrigations can be helpful too. So just a regular nasal saline spray. I like one of the misting type. It's a little bit more gentle. And you can also do irrigations where you can use distilled water and you'll irrigate your nasal passages to help remove some of the allergens so that they're not sitting up there. And when you have allergies, your nasal passages are inflamed and irritated. So you're at an increased risk of developing sinus infections and things like that during allergy season. But I'd say the key is starting these treatments early in the season rather than waiting until the symptoms are severe, because by that time your nasal passages are all angry. You do want to make sure that if you are using one of the irrigation products that you use distilled water. And this is one of the things that sounds like a myth, but it really isn't. You can get some of, you've heard of the brain-eating amoebas. It's very, very rare, but that's why you want to make sure that you use the distilled water. You don't want to use water from the faucet when you're irrigating your nasal passages.
That was Advent Health family medicine physician, Dr. Ariana Becker. Coming up, Powerline workers take their skills to new heights in Central Florida. How they're showcasing their expertise at the Florida Lineman's Rodeo. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
You are listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. When congressional districts are divided by population, people incarcerated in prisons within those districts are counted as residents, even though they cannot vote. This paradigm is used to weigh districts toward a favorable party. It is one of the reasons politicians often seek prison placement in their districts. In addition to providing jobs, it can also influence elections. Michael Wessler is a communications director with the Prison Policy Initiative, a nonprofit with a mission of conducting research on inconsistencies in the American penal system. He joined Engage to talk with producer Richard Copeland about the impact of prisoner gerrymandering on voting communities.
The Census Bureau has a policy that counts incarcerated people as residents of the prison or jail that they're held in. Now, this is against kind of common notions about how incarceration works. While people often think when someone goes to prison or jail, they're there, they stay there, and they don't move for long periods of time. That's generally not the case. This is especially true with jails, where people are usually awaiting trial. They're usually there for days, weeks, or at the longest, months most of the time. Whereas prisons, there are some people who are there for months and years, but they're generally there not for the full 10 years in between census periods where the census determines where people are counted. And even those people who are in a prison for longer than 10 years, they're usually shipped between facilities. So the Census Bureau counts them at the prison, even though they're very likely, almost certainly not going to be at that prison for the entire 10 years.
What happens to residents within a congressional district when prison inmates are counted as part of that community within a U.S. Census?
What happens when you count incarcerated people as residents of those districts? You artificially inflate the population of those districts. You know, so if you have a few prisons in there that have a total incarcerated population of 5 or 10,000 people, that will artificially inflate the population of that district. Now, when lawmakers go to draw new state legislative lines or county commissions draw new county commission lines, they're using that artificially inflated population to draw those lines. What that does is it gives those communities that contain prisons a little bit of extra political clout. What I mean by that is, you know, if you have a state legislative district, let's say it had 100,000 people in it, but 10,000 of them are incarcerated, that means you have 90,000 people who are competing to get their priorities heard in that district, whereas in every other district, it's 100,000 people. So you got 10% greater chance of having your concerns heard by your elected officials in Tallahassee if you have a prison than any community that doesn't have a prison. Now, the other part of this is it dilutes the political power of communities that have high incarceration rates. You know, those people are losing population unfairly, and that population is being given to communities that contain prisons. And it's important to note that, you know, high incarceration rates happen across the state and across the country. You know, there's this common misconception that it's only urban areas and big cities that have high incarceration rates. And while it is true that big cities like Orlando tend to have the most raw number of people who are incarcerated, in actuality, rural areas often have as high, if not higher, incarceration rates than the big cities. And this makes sense when you think about it. If you think about some of the main reasons that people end up behind bars, it's issues related to poverty, it's issues related to substance use disorders, it's issues related to untreated mental health conditions. And all of those factors we know are incredibly common in rural communities too. So this is a problem where everyone in the state that doesn't have a prison in their state legislative district is losing some political power. That's almost every resident of the state is losing some political power, and it's being concentrated in just a handful of state legislative districts where people get a louder voice in the halls of the state legislature. And that's a problem called prison gerrymandering.
So without sounding conspiratorial, does this contribute to where states choose to place prisons?
Yeah, you know, this is a question we get often, and it's kind of a chicken or the egg sort of problem. You know, prison gerrymandering has been a problem that's been around since the beginning of the census. There have been incarcerated people, and the Census Bureau has always counted those incarcerated people as residents of that prison or jail. And people often say, you know, why are we just hearing about this problem now? The census has been going on for more than 200 years. And it really goes back to the 80s and 90s when the country took on this experiment of mass incarceration, where they thought if we lock up more and more people, build more and more prisons, that's how we'll tackle crime. Now, that's been an abysmal failure. You know, study after study has shown that locking more people up doesn't make communities safer. It actually tears communities apart. And there's a lot better ways to deal with crime. But around the year 2000, when they did that census, that's when people really started to notice that these rural communities that previously had seen their populations declining suddenly had these booms and had a much higher population than anyone expected. That's when people first recognized that prison gerrymandering was a problem. So it's really an outgrowth of the mass incarceration experiment that the country's been on. So it didn't happen intentionally. It didn't start as an intentional problem. Now, certainly, you know, those communities are getting a louder voice in the halls of the legislature than they otherwise would have. So it certainly goes to reason that lawmakers may have an incentive to keep those prisons full or maybe even build new prisons in there. I don't think there's any lawmaker who would ever explicitly say, please build a prison in my community so that I get more political clout out of it. You know, we don't have that sort of smoking gun, but it certainly goes to reason that if somebody's community is benefiting unfairly through prison gerrymandering, they may be incentivized to make that problem benefit them even more.
And you're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. We are talking with Michael Wessler, Communications Director for the Prison Policy Initiative. Now, Michael, one of the things I want to get to is when we're looking at this a lot through the prism of voting and how this gerrymandering dilutes the voting power of residents, both in the communities of the prison and in communities that have high incarceration rates when those people are not counted as part of that community. So outside of voting, can you speak to the way in which census data is used in funding mechanisms for various programming that impacts both of these communities?
Yeah, that's a really important point because it gets to something that kind of goes against conventional wisdom when it comes to prison gerrymandering and the impact on funding. Now, every 10 years, we're told to fill out your census form and it's going to bring a certain number of dollars back to your home community. And that is a really well-intentioned and successful campaign that gets people to fill out their census forms because otherwise, you know, it's kind of a hassle. You don't understand what's in it for you. Now, the problem with those campaigns is it oversimplifies how the census impacts federal funding allocations. And what I mean by that is it's not a one-to-one kind of conversion where if you fill this out, your community's going to automatically receive X number of dollars. Census data is used to determine how federal funding is spent, but it's one of many, many factors that determines it, such as, you know, if you have a program that is designed to and money designed to combat childhood hunger, you might use that census data as one factor, but you're also going to use data about poverty in that community. You're going to use data about the age of the residents in that community. So it's not a one-to-one sort of transition. Now, how this relates to prison gerrymandering is people often are tempted to say, well, if you address prison gerrymandering, these communities that contain prisons are going to lose money. And that's just not the case. And there's a couple of different reasons that's not the case. One, the state of Florida is going to continue to fund the prisons that it has, regardless of where those incarcerated people are counted. It's going to continue to have to staff those prisons, pay for maintenance of those prisons, spend all the same amount of money that it is. It's going to have to employ the same number of people that it does, regardless of whether those incarcerated people are counted there. Secondly, when you address prison gerrymandering, if Florida were to take this step, it would simply be changing how the census data is used for drawing state legislative district lines, as opposed to changing the underlying data. The census data as it is going to be the same. The federal government, unfortunately, has drug its feet on this issue for more than two decades now, and we don't anticipate they're going to change it for 2030. So the underlying census data, we think in 2030, is going to continue to count incarcerated people in the wrong place. And any program that uses census data to determine how funding is allocated is going to continue to use that flawed census data. What we're talking about is how state lawmakers in Florida can draw a more accurate picture and ensure that every Florida resident gets an equal voice in government. That's really what prison gerrymandering is about. It's about political power rather than federal dollars.
And one of the other things that was notable in the PPI report is that this disproportionately impacts Black voters in Florida.
Absolutely. You know, you can't talk about any aspect of the criminal legal system without talking about the racial disparities that are inherent in it. Black and brown people are overrepresented at every stage of the criminal legal system. They're over-policed, they're over-incarcerated, they're punished more punitively every step of the way. And what's really insidious about prison gerrymandering is it takes those racial disparities in the criminal legal system and converts them to political power. And what I mean by that is because Black people are incarcerated at a higher rate, their voices are their political clout is transferred to a different community at a higher rate. So Black communities lose some of their already minimal political power in a lot of places. They lose it to prison gerrymandering. And oftentimes, that political power is instead given to communities that are disproportionately white. You know, in Florida, it's important to note that 15% of the state population is Black. However, 48% of the people who are behind bars are Black. So there's a big disparity there. And that disparity represents political power that is lost from Black communities. It's making sure that Black people who have had difficulty getting their voice heard in government for centuries in this country, it makes it even harder for them to have their voice heard.
That was Prison Policy Initiative Communications Director Michael Wessler speaking with Engage producer Richard Copeland. This past Saturday, hundreds of electrical line workers gathered in Winter Garden with friends, family, and curious onlookers. Engage producer Richard Copeland was on site for this year's Florida Linemen's Rodeo.
Country music echoed as life-sized human mannequins were hoisted 30 feet in the air and hung from electrical poles. Massive Duke Energy response trucks with giant tank treads and ominously large auger screws hanging off the sides, lined the road to the Florida Lineman's Rodeo.
There you go, tighten it up. There you go, go with it, go. Quick, you got it tight. Hey, ho, ho, wrap it, wrap it, wrap it.
This is not your average rodeo. There are no bulls, no broncos, no cowboys. There are four narrow fields of grass, roped off, and each with four or five electrical poles lined up in a row. They're identical to the ones you'd see outside your home, carrying electricity through your community and right into your radio, your refrigerator, your air conditioner. The only difference is there is no electricity running through these lines.
Good? Yeah, got it. Hey, hey, you gotta give me some slack, right?
Just a reminder, once again, last
time
was at the DJ booth. If you found something you lost, something you found.
Hosted by Duke Energy, the Florida Lineman's Rodeo attracts line workers from around the state to compete against each other in performing various tasks routine to the job. And for these crews, that means a couple dozen feet off the ground, gripping a wooden pole while changing out breakers, bypassing power lines, and rescuing injured workers, which explains the mannequins.
You gotta go up the pole, he's got his buck squeeze on, he's gonna have to transition over that spool. Typically, that's where our neutral line is. We don't have the neutral there, it's just the spool. He'll transition over that, he'll get up to the top, and he'll secure himself, wrap the rope around the dummy mannequin, and then tie some three knots.
That's Brian Edling, a supervisor with Duke Energy. Today, he's supervising the safety competition. Teams of two collaborate to rescue a dummy. One climbs, the other holds a safety rope and provides direction from the ground.
Hey, no, do me a judge, he's in the hose.
Edling is timing the teams and keeping score based on their attention to safety and the nuances of each task.
Anytime you drop something from the pole, you got a yellow headache. Let the people on the ground know material's coming down. He's gonna take the rope, go up underneath him, and wrap it up around his arms.
While there is a relaxed vibe in the sense these competitors are practicing on de-energized lines, in the spirit of sport and competition, they are intensely focused on their tasks and the prospects of winning much coveted bragging rights among the regional line crews that are represented at the rodeo. As lineman Tanner O'Shea explains.
This is a time for us to basically show our skills. We definitely, safety's the biggest thing with it, but we also are stretching ourselves to the max here because we know everything's dead, but we simulate it like it, we're working to energize. So we will take that extra mile that we wouldn't take in the field on a regular day-to-day work to see if we can compete and win the event.
For Tanner, working on the lines isn't just a job. It's part of his family's legacy.
My dad's been working here at the company ever since I was a kid. He retired after 37 years here. And so I grew up in it my whole life. And at 18 years old, I started in the industry.
Like Tanner, most of the line workers start in their teens. Companies like Duke work closely with area colleges to develop programs to cultivate a workforce for the future.
Valencia College is one. We have Lake Sumter State College, Seminole State College, St. Petersburg College. Colleges where we give them grants to have electrical line worker programs, training the next generation of line workers. Really helps them get into the field while also giving us a steady talent pipeline. They come out here and they are volunteering today. They're meeting with our executives, getting that experience and networking that will help them in their careers.
That's Ali Coleman Rashid, a spokesperson for Duke Energy. At 23 years old, Richard Lee is one of those just beginning a career as a line worker. He talks about how he entered this field.
You start out as an apprentice, you have different classes you got to go through, and then once you complete all those classes, there's like one a year, everything, and then you just keep working your way up, and then eventually you'll become a lineman.
How far away are you from the line?
A couple more months.
Pretty psyched?
Yeah, I'm ready.
And like Tanner, line work is in Richard's blood.
It's been in the family for a long time. It's something I've always wanted to do since I was a little kid, so I just wanted to pursue it. I love it every day, so good outside work, hanging out. You got great people in the trade, so a lot of good friends you make, family, so it's great.
I asked Richard what part of working on the lines he most looked forward to.
I'm looking forward to, so you're helping out others, storm work, you're getting lights on, people that are out of power for many days, they're in need, so you're out there helping them, getting everything on as quickly and safely as you can, so it's good.
The training for these guys is kind of like boot camp or the police academy. Safety is paramount when dealing with extreme loads of electricity.
It's one of the most dangerous jobs in the world, and you know, our biggest saying is be your brother's keeper, so we are a family. We work with these guys more day in and day out, and we spend more time with the guys at work than we do with our own families.
But like any young grads, they're eager to get into the field. Tanner Miller remembers his first day on the lines.
It was interesting. First day in the field, we go out. I have no idea what I'm doing, and we're working in an orange grove and changing poles out, and I'm running around like a chicken with my head cut off, not knowing anything.
And when I asked Tanner what makes a good day on the line, he gave me an answer that was a common through line when I talked to other workers.
Probably watching all the customer smiles whenever we get their power back on. You know, seeing that's probably the most rewarding thing. When something happens and customers are out of power, us restoring them, I think is my favorite thing.
Back on the competition field, I'm watching a three-man crew simulate a line repair. Anna Gibbs of Duke Energy is providing play-by-play commentary.
I'm waiting here to see what the wrench there that they're using. It looks like they may be removing that fuse. I think that's what he's doing right now. It looks like he's removing a fuse. That fuse is a lot like you would see in the breaker in your house. So it's very similar, obviously much different because this is a much more powerful line. And that does appear what he's doing is he's removing a fuse is right now what he's doing.
There you go, go with it, go. Quick, you got it tight. Hey, ho, ho, wrap it, wrap it, wrap it.
For the energy companies participating in the competition, the day is about recruitment, training, and branding. But for the competitors, it's about pride, family, and fun.
Hold the line out, sweetie. Just hold the tag out for it. There you go.
That was Engage producer Richard Copeland at the Florida Linemen's Rodeo last Saturday in Winter Garden. That's all for this week's edition of Engage. I'm Sharon Stone. Thank you for the company. NPR News is next.